Hello, hello, and welcome back to another episode of Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, and classic cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and we are in the middle of Season 4, the Art House Starter Pack. This is intended for newbies to art house movies or people who want to learn more about artsy movies. This is a good starter pack, a good first set of six movies that we've been working through, and you can find the full list in your show notes. Today we are talking about a film from 1985 called Vagabond, from French director Agnès Varda. And Varda is interesting for a number of reasons. She just passed away recently in the past couple of years, and she was making movies her entire life, and was a big part of the French New Wave back several years ago. We're going to talk about some more details about that, but this movie follows a young French woman who has decided not to live as part of society, essentially, and she sort of hitchhikes and finds odd jobs and kind of struggles through life, but she has a sort of freedom, but she also her life is very difficult. So anyway, we'll get into all of that, but it's a really interesting movie and one of her most well-known. And with me again to discuss it is my friend and filmmaker Andrew Camarillo. So Andrew, thanks for being back once again. How are you doing, and is there anything you've been watching lately you want to tell us about?
Hi, Andrew. Yes, I recently watched Kelly's Hollywood that you had recommended and had you've done a podcast on.
That's great.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was beautiful, moving, and informative. It's a great film. I'm not sure if maybe you could talk about it a bit more, but the interactions were great between the brother who's making the film and his sister. It was really moving to see, and I thought it depicted like intimacy and siblings that was just great.
Yeah, it's a great movie. I'm so glad you watched it. It's not super well known. It's a documentary, as you mentioned, by a director named Brian Donovan, who I've had the pleasure of meeting. He's on my podcast, if you look back at season one, two episodes, I think, because we talked so long. But his sister is an adult who has Down syndrome, and she had a love for Hollywood. That's not a spoiler, I guess, to say she's since passed away, but he made this documentary about her, and they were incredibly close, had a really interesting sibling relationship, and he helped her he basically wanted her to kind of follow her dreams of learning more about Hollywood and being part of Hollywood. And it's really a good portrait of the sibling relationship and just an adult with Down syndrome, which was particularly interesting to me. Actually, I have two children, and both of them have Down syndrome, and so I have a lot of experience with kids with Down syndrome. But seeing Kelly's Hollywood, you kind of experience what can up close look at what her life is like, and her hopes and dreams, her fears and her desires, and all of that. And it's really a fascinating movie. So yeah, go watch that if you're able to. I believe it is streaming somewhere. I'm not sure where. Maybe Showtime or
Amazon. Amazon. I found it on Amazon. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you can listen to my interview with the director. Well, that's cool. Thanks. Thanks for watching it. I guess you wanted to, but
I did. And I thought your at the episode that you did on the podcast about it with the director was really cool, and it made me excited about watching it. I had been waiting for quite some time, and I finally got around to it, but it was really great. And I was happy to see it. Vanessa and I actually watched it together, and she lives in Canada, and she was unable to access it via Amazon, but she contacted the director online, and he kind of helped her out to getting to see it. So I thought that was really great.
Oh, that's awesome. He's an incredibly nice guy. I'm Facebook friends with him. He's always posting just beautiful things about wanting to put love into the world. And anyway, he's a really incredible person. Brian Donovan is his name.
I was going to say he actually said the Swetmans are like great people or something. Like he had said something like that, like a top notch, I think is what he said. So
that's so kind of him. Yeah. It's funny. So my wife has a podcast as well. It's about kind of advocacy and different things that she interviewed him as well. She had him first on her podcast, and then he came to my podcast within a couple of weeks. It was just funny. So you can go find Oh So Extra is her podcast if you want more from Brian Donovan, more on the advocacy side of stuff. But well, that's so great. Cool. I'm so glad that you did that. Well, mine's not that personal or exciting, but I watched The Silence, Ingmar Bergman film
from 1963. Awesome. Yeah.
So there's sort of a loose trilogy around Through a Glass Darkly, Winter Light, and then The Silence as sort of the last one. And I had seen the first two of those like a year ago. And I've been watching through Bergman and Winter Light. I kind of took a long break because I loved it so much. I wanted to like take it in. And for some reason, it was just hard to move forward. But I finally did, I think, Seventh Seal again recently for the podcast. It kind of motivated me. And it was really good. It's an interesting one. It's unlike any of the others that I've seen from him in a lot of ways. I think it's about two sisters, basically, that are traveling. And they stop at this hotel, and the older sister is very sick, and she's coughing and seems on the verge of death, and she can't travel anymore, and so they're not quite home. So they're kind of weirdly in flux. They're trying to get home. There seems to be a war that's breaking out in this unusual town that I think it's a fictional town. They don't speak the language, so they're like fish out of water in a lot of ways. Also, the younger sister has a young son, and we're seeing a lot of things happen through his eyes. And then basically the conflict between the sisters is the main draw of it. And the younger sister is a bit promiscuous, perhaps a word that could apply to her. And the older sister is very serious and kind of judgmental. And that all kind of comes to a head. But it's kind of a small story in some ways. It's just really a few characters, and but it has some really funny moments. It has some really moving moments, some really strange, unusual moments. But yeah, I really liked it. It's probably one that I liked it probably a little less than Winter Light and Seventh Seal and some of the others. But I it's definitely going to stick in my head. Have you seen it before?
I have, yes. It was it's been some years, but I felt like it was quite dark. I mean, yeah. Winter Light was dark, but just the tone, and I think the lighting in some of the scenes, and yeah, the atmosphere created between the sisters was kind of this, almost in a way, like The Silence, I think, is a fitting name, because it seems like communication was very difficult, like reaching out and connecting to the other. Yeah. And then also, like you said, being in the town where the area where they don't speak the language, it felt really in a way inaccessible, not the film, but the interactions between people and what each person's feeling. And I thought that was it was powerful, but also a bit dark, but I thought it was really good. But I prefer Winter Light in that trilogy, I think, overall. But I think it's a fitting conclusion to that group of films.
Yeah, I agree. I think the thing about it, maybe, like, if you look at the poster, it seems like at the time it was incredibly sexually provocative for what it was showing back in 1963. So even on the poster, it's got quotes from all these critics saying, like, yeah, it's got a lot of sex in it, but it's also really good. Like, it's an adult, like, well thought out movie. And I can just sense that a lot of people were keeping it at arm's length for that reason back then.
Right.
But yeah, it was a good one, and I'm excited to keep moving too. I think Persona is next, which I've been really excited about. So that's going to be some point for me in the next little bit. But so that's what I've been watching. Well, great. I guess without further ado, let's get on into Vagabond.
Ouais, je dors.
Mais vous savez où vous êtes là?
Ben non, je suis arrivé dans la nuit.
Mais c'est un cimetière, il faut pas rester là.
Oh. Hey, y'a pas un petit boulot pour nettoyer les tombes?
All All right, let's talk about Vagabond from Agnès Varda. So this movie, can you pronounce the original French title? I'm looking at it, but I don't speak French.
But... No, I should be able to, but I can't.
Okay, it's Sans Toit Niloy, which may be way off. So I apologize to any French speakers. I'm going to look up the translation of that again because I can't quite remember what it is. But it's not exactly Vagabond, but it's sort of related. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's the translation is with neither shelter nor law.
Yeah, that's what I'm pulling up to. Yeah, neither shelter nor law, which is a little more descriptive maybe than just the word vagabond, because she is, yeah, without shelter and kind of lives outside of the law. So this movie is about a young woman named Mona, and she, at the beginning of the movie, her corpse is discovered in a ditch. She's dead. And then it, we get a documentary style voiceover, which that's something Agnès Varda is known for, which I'm sure we'll talk more about, is mixing kind of documentary and narrative styles. So we get, I think it's Agnès Varda's voice saying, people didn't know a lot about Mona. And they didn't, many people didn't know her name. And I basically, she's saying that she went back and found the people that interacted with her in her last several weeks of her life and talked to them without telling them that she was dead, just getting their impressions of her. And I think it's key that she didn't say, this person is now deceased. So anyway, then we go back and we walk with Mona through these things. And then we cut to these interviews with the people around her, that she's, sometimes we get that interview and then it jumps into the interaction she had with that person. And we have their impressions of her. So that's kind of the main setup. And then it, so we know at the end of this movie, she's going to die. And so we're kind of marching towards that the entire time. So that's sort of the basic setup. She interacts with a lot of different people and she's, a vagabond is probably a good word. She, is hitchhiking. She's finding work where she can get it. She's doesn't have much food. Doesn't have shelter often, and kind of drifting through life. And then she has really interesting conversations with people about what's good about that, what's bad about that, and really it opens up a lot of questions, I think, for the audience more than answering anything. But yeah, I really was a fan of this, and I've seen one other Varda film, and I had always wanted to watch this one, so I'm really glad that I have, and I really enjoyed it. So yeah, tell me, Andrew, what your impression of it is and kind of what your relationship is with Vagabond.
I had seen Vagabond once before. Coming back to the film now and engaging with it, I think was really good to do. Agnès Varda is someone that I think is really important in cinema history. And I feel like this is, like you had said earlier, one of her most well-known films and also critically acclaimed films. This film was very powerful to me. I actually watched it once and then went back, and today I watched it again just to go through it again and to try to feel, I would get maybe a new perspective on it, because I feel like throughout the film, the setup is we're learning about Mona through other people's perspectives, mm-hmm. from their recollections of her. We are seeing images of her that I guess would be realistic, but as we know, like Agnes, she's known for blurring the lines between fiction and reality, documentary style filmmaking and fiction. But yeah, I really was moved by this film, and I was excited to watch it again. It's a film that opens up a lot of questions and allows the viewer to ask a lot of questions about what's going on or what's happening or how would we interact with a person like this. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It struck me that it kind of can tie back to a couple of movies that I've discuss on this podcast, one with you, and that's The Seventh Seal, because at the beginning of that we talked about how it seemed like they just washed up out of the water almost, like we have the knight and the squire just laying on the beach and you're not sure if they're even alive for a second at the beginning of that. And very similarly after this, after her body's discovered and it kind of cuts back in time, we see her just walking up out of the water, and Agnes Varda's voiceover even says, "It seemed to me as if she came from the sea." And it's like, right, maybe this was her birth. And she's also, she's at a, quite a distance, but you can see she doesn't have any clothes on. So it is almost like a birth. She's coming into the world for the first time and kind of representing that. And then the other connection is to Citizen Kane, which was last season, but very similar setup in a way that we start with a death and then we try to piece together this person's life through bits and pieces and other people. Different execution. I probably prefer this as far as what I would want to watch again. I'm actually really anxious to watch this again, just because I think I will. It's a very rich film, even though it's pretty straightforward and the plot is very simple in a way, but it as you mentioned, brings up a lot of questions, and I think those will be good to revisit. But yeah, that's kind of my impression of the beginning. There's several things about this that I kind of don't know where to jump in first, but let me just kind of run through my notes here about kind of things that I responded to. One thing, so this also ties back to something we talked about last week. So we kind of talked a little bit about a reader response theory of criticism, literary criticism, which we're getting nerdy already, but basically that's talking about, does a work of art, does its meaning and its value come from the creator who is putting it together, or from the responses of the audience? So like, maybe the meaning of a film is made by the people watching it, not necessarily by the artist. And I think it's probably both, but reader response tends to focus on the meaning, or what the audience is getting out of it, is the most important thing. And that similar question is asked about like people in general in this, because we see her, but as you said, most of our impressions of her are other people's opinions. And so it brings up, you know, is our identity something internal, or is it based on how we come off to people, basically? And I think that's a really interesting question, and it makes you think about, and I heard a quote once, I'm just remembering, I can't remember where I heard this, but I'll try to find it and put in the show notes. But basically it's like there's a lot of different versions of who you are, basically an infinite number, or as many as the people as you know. And so you think about that, like, well, my wife knows one version of me, my parents know another version of me, my friends know another version of me. And so that just makes you think about identity and perception in a way that's mind-boggling in a way, but also kind of beautiful to think about. And so it's kind of, what's the most important thing about Mona? Is it who Mona is, or is it how people perceived her? And it doesn't exactly answer that, but it again opens that question.
Yeah, Vanessa, when we watched the film, she stated to me that she felt as though we are learning more about the characters themselves based on their assessments and what they said about her, what they felt about her, and how they talked about Mona and their interactions with her. We learned so much about them. And for Mona, I think Agnes Varda said it's almost like an impossible portrait. She couldn't really create something. She even said something like in the film when she was talking about, but it seems to me she came from the sea. Before that, she said, I know little about her myself. And it seems as though even Agnes Varda, in interviews about this film, she was sort of saying that she herself had created a character that she didn't know fully, and that she was learning in some way about her, or understanding her through the lens of other people. And by doing that, we kind of get a portrait of these different people in the French countryside, these people in this certain landscape, which I think is really interesting. And yeah, Vanessa brought that to my attention. I thought that was really interesting. So
yeah, I like that. I mean, some people write her off immediately and immediately judge her because the way, you know, she doesn't seem very clean because she's been on the road and that kind of thing. And then other people show her kindness and even want to take her in, and sometimes that lasts and sometimes it doesn't. And mostly it doesn't, because we know where this goes in the end. But yeah, that's a really interesting. That's a really interesting thing. And I think, as I mentioned in the beginning, the fact that the people being interviewed don't know that she's dead. I think that's really important because they, in a way, are giving their truest reactions to her, which it is so interesting because it's constructed. Like, this is a narrative that Varda has written, even though she's trying to discover this too, and kind of getting at the idea of, like, how do we get to know a person? I think if the people being interviewed knew that she was, that Mona had died, we automatically switch into more kind mode when we're talking about someone who's no mm-hmm. longer with us. Right. And so right. That's an interesting thing, but also, the documentary style is that, so my understanding is that a lot of these people are non-professional actors that
right.
they may be literally people that were around, and she said, "Hey, can you be in this movie for a minute?" It's kind of my understanding of how that went. Is that accurate? Do you know?
Yes, that she, many of the characters, the actors were non-professional, and she wrote lines for many of them. For example, the farmer, he was like living that way. The philosopher or ex-philosopher farmer, she was writing lines for him. And he wouldn't have been in the film if it was a documentary, but since it was fiction, he decided to, she said.
Even though he's playing a version of himself, basically.
Yes.
Wow. So he really was an ex-philosopher turned goat farmer.
That's what he said. Yes.
That's really interesting. Wow. Yeah. That's so she, it seemed like she, the process of making this, she would come across someone and kind of write them into this story in a way. Wow. That's really interesting. There's a scene pretty early in the movie where she is, she and another, I don't know, homeless person basically are, sort of squatting in this big, villa, like this big home that's full of fine art. And, it's interesting. So she uses her sexuality in some ways, it seems like to, you know, for shelter, like to get in people's good graces so they'll take her in. And that's kind of what happens here. She's with this man and they, and they're kissing a lot and that sort of thing. There's a moment that kind of stuck out to me that, they're kind of making out, but right in front of this, several pieces of fine art. And then, and also she's, kind of reclining. There's a moment where there's like a statue in like the garden of this home that's like reclining on a bench, and she reclines next to it, almost making the same pose. And it just made me think that Varda's, it seems like she has a deep love for humanity as a filmmaker. And so she's kind of equating these things, saying, here's artists of old have put these things in sculptures and in paintings, and these people that are saying, you know, this is important, this is a thing that's worthy enough to make art out of. And I think the same thing of this, you know, transient woman also, that she seeing the human dignity in every person, and even someone who a lot of society might write off. She's a homeless person and hitchhiking around, but Varda seems to be seeing the beauty in her, even as, and I think maybe I'm just kind of piecing this together as I go, but the fact that she herself, the filmmaker, is trying to find that beauty, it's showing that that's a worthy thing for us to do. And that's a beautiful thing for us to do, is to try to see the good in people and understand that everyone at their core maybe is worthy of love and that sort of thing. So that's an interesting thing.
Yeah. I felt like also Mona seemed often kind of unknowable in ways, didn't express a lot. But when she did express at certain times, it felt as if it really meant something when there was an expression of emotion. I think one of Vanessa's favorite scenes, she said, and I really liked it as well, where she has the painting from the chateau or the villa that you're speaking of, mm-hmm. and she had taken it, and she pulls it out of her bag after she has left, because the young man she was there with has been beaten up by thieves who have come into the chateau to steal things. She leaves and she takes this painting out of her bag, but there she notices there's a hole in it, and mm-hmm. she's incredibly upset because now the painting for her is like destroyed. Mm-hmm. So she throws it into a fire in front of her, and she kind of yells or wails out in some way. Mm-hmm. And there are a few instances of, you know, intense emotions that she's feeling that we can see. And that's one of them. And I also related that to when she's arranging photo images or like postcards from, I guess, travels around the world. I guess she found potentially, or she may have bought, and she's sort of arranging them and looking at them. She has this aesthetic appreciation, even though, you know, she, I think, went to vocational school, she said, but she didn't go beyond that. And she just has, and she's living the life of a vagabond. She has this aesthetic appreciation. Mm-hmm. She has this sense of beauty and wanting to discover it, wanting to know it. And I think in some of these gestures, we can know more of her, of Mona.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Like, we know so little about her at the beginning that we're kind of grasping for those things. And so you really do pay attention to, like, what does she find interesting? What does she find beautiful? And that's how we're kind of getting to know our protagonist. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah. Let's talk about that philosopher. So she comes across a goat farm, and she ends up spending a good bit of time with the family there. It's a mother and father and one child, is that right? Maybe more than one.
Maybe two children, smaller children, at least one, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's hundreds of goats, or maybe around 100 goats. And the father of the family is this, as we mentioned, he's an ex-philosopher. We find out that he has been to school and has like a master's degree and all this, and part of the conversation is she is incredulous as to why he would live like this if he had this education. He could be working in the city and making more money and have an easier life in some ways. They have some conflict. So initially he's really kind to her, and he's never cruel to her, but he says, you know, you can stay in this trailer and you can have some land if you want, because she talks about kind of dreaming of planting potatoes and living off the land herself. And he seems to respect that. And he puts her up in this trailer, and basically she doesn't do anything besides read, sit in the trailer and read most of the time, it seems like. And he confronts her finally and is like, you're not doing anything. Like, and she's kind of expressed some ideals that she's unhappy with society. And he says, you have no right to do that because you don't do anything. And he says, you don't exist, at one point, because you don't do anything. And I thought that was interesting. Mm-hmm. So the film itself is making importance out of Mona's existence. And so we hear him saying, you don't exist. And he's this voice of, I don't know, that it kind of gets at like a capitalistic idea of people's worth comes from their usefulness or their value,
right,
to society.
Yeah. Yes. I thought that was interesting because while he is quite giving with the land and also the place to stay for her, when she doesn't work or do as he thinks she should do, he's like, okay, you're not doing what you should be doing. And it doesn't seem like a long time has passed. And he's right. Just already like, okay, you need to get up, you need to do things. And she says something like, before I was a vagabond, basically, she had a boss and then she quit, and she quit the boss. She didn't go out on the road to find another boss, referring to the farmer. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you, this sense of, in some ways, it seems like the farmer is representative, from some reading I did about what Agnes Varda said, of a mentality in the 60s, that this sense of freedom that has ideation or ideological roots of like principle, this specific way of living, even though it's utopian and idealistic, it's still based on some principles or some ideology, while Mona seems to represent almost this new sense of freedom, this kind of revolt against society without a specific principle that we can tell. There's not a lot of ideas going on there. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really interesting because in some ways it seems like the farmer is being judgmental and critical to make the claim, like you said, a capitalistic claim of, well, you're not being useful, so you don't really exist. And later in the film, he is very critical of like, she's just supporting the system itself and kind of like validating it by not being useless in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. That their interactions were some of my favorite parts of the movie, some of the most interesting things there. I guess moving on in the plot, she comes across, I guess she's hitchhiking, and a woman picks her up who is seems pretty wealthy, and she is strangely just happy to have her as a companion in her car. So Mona is basically living in her car, for I don't know, a few days or a couple of weeks or something. It's not exactly made clear, but they have some interesting conversations about why she's doing what she's doing. And for me, the most striking, one of the most striking images in the film comes when they are at a cafe of some kind having breakfast or lunch, and there's this close-up of both of their hands just inches apart on the table, and Mona's hands are filthy, like, you know, she has dirt under her fingernails, and you can just tell she's not, and it's been stated that she hasn't bathed in a while, and that she doesn't smell very good. Mm. And then you have the other woman whose hands are immaculate and done up and bejeweled. And I don't know, there's just a, that was a striking way of kind of showing that they are at very different places in society, but still of the same quality. Like, hands are hands, you know, and there's something kind of universally human about that. But, and that's, and I have not I've seen only one other Varda film, but I have listened to podcasts actually about her, and so I know that something that does recur in some of her other films is close-ups of hands. So when I saw that, I keyed into that, and I think one of her later movies, she talks about her own hands at one point. Varda does, but yeah. Anyway, that was a an interesting scene there, and a really nice shot. You have any thoughts about any of the interactions with her?
Yeah, I think I really like that shot as well, and I think that the woman who picked her up, she was, I think, a tree expert, a tree specialist.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Who is engaged in finding out about a fungus and trying to stop this fungus that was spreading among certain trees in the area. And that it was kind of like a fungus that was a cancer to these trees and killed them very quickly. But I really like that, even though she was of a different, like, social class, and you could tell that she sort of acted and behaved as if she was part of that social class. When she met Mona, she was very humane in her questions. Mm-hmm. She ate with her, she engaged with her, she joked with her. She was not putting herself, like, above her, at least from what I could tell in the film. Mm-hmm. And I really thought the interactions were earnest. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed that. And one of my favorite lines in the film was when she asked her, well, why did you kind of drop out of school? Why didn't you, like, continue? And Mona responds, champagne on the road is better.
So, yeah, she's sitting there drinking her champagne bottle.
Right. So she just this very simple but elegant line that this is just a lot better than continuing on working, having a career, to me. I really liked this character, and I thought she was one of the most humane and considerate characters in the film, at least in how I saw her.
Yeah.
She also said something later I thought that was interesting when she's being interviewed, that she felt sort of a reproach after she had been electrocuted, which was a very strange moment in the film. It was like, whoa, mm-hmm. what's happening?
Yeah.
One of her assistants.
Yeah.
One of her assistants helped her out and got her away from that. And she said the images of her life flashed before her eyes, as many people, I think, say when they mm-hmm. are electrocuted or, like, have that
near-death experience.
Yeah. And the images of Mona came back in her mind as a reproach. Like, could I have done more? Like, and I think she did a lot. I mean, comparatively mm-hmm. to how some people engage with Mona, of course. So, but she still had a sense of reproach, and she still had this sense that, hey, maybe I should have done something more than what I did. And I thought that was really interesting. And yeah, she was sort of a humane voice mm-hmm. In this film that was filled with, in some ways, like, violent, obviously sexual violence that we don't that is implied. We see some aggressiveness, and the camera moves away. We see people speaking about her in ways that are I think some other vagabonds she meets talking to her about, you know, pornography or whatever. There are people who in the film who really are, and it's mostly obviously the men who are very dismissive, abusive, or neglectful,
exploitative,
exploitative, and that's That was really difficult to see, but we do get these images and interactions with some of the female characters that were much more humane, and I enjoyed that.
Yeah, and that's a good transition to one of my next things I want to talk about is the old woman in we found out Yolanda is a character that comes back a couple of times, but Mona has this really unusual interaction with this wealthy old woman who we're not sure how good her vision is at one point, and she really shouldn't even be interacting with her. She's supposed to like going to get in trouble for going in here, and she ends up pouring brandy for this old woman, and they have this incredible moment where they're just laughing together, and this old woman is so funny, and she's just laughing and laughing, and then this is really genuine emotion that you feel from them, and that was a striking moment for one thing, because it's so funny, and this movie doesn't have that many points of humor, so that it stuck out to me for that reason. But then I actually, on the Criterion channel, there are some really good kind of special features around this, and there's a short about the old lady, and she had never acted before, but Agnes Varda, I guess it seemed like in this short documentary about her, one of her assistants went out to find an old woman who would star, and actually in a short film that she was making as well, and then ended up using her in Vagabond as well. And she talked about how she thought it was so funny that she was a servant her whole life, and now she got to play someone who was bossing a servant around. Like, she said she had been a maid, and she'd worked her entire life in these kind of lower class things. And then it plays again the moment where they're laughing together. And Varda's voiceover says, "In their laughter, social class disappears." And so so for one thing, you see like they really were laughing together. Like, it really was a beautiful moment between those two, even though it was, you know, partially constructed for this movie. I think that's maybe part of the magic of this quasi-documentary style, is that that was genuine between those two, and that you see these two characters who, yeah, again, are in very different social places. Kind of like that shot of the hands, we see that as Varda says, their social class disappears. Like, you see their humanity and not their status, I guess. And I think that's so beautiful and really a striking moment.
I didn't know that the backstory, the documentary you're speaking of, like that's really cool. I did feel like when I watched it that moment was very genuine and felt spontaneous almost. It was really well done. So that's really cool.
Yeah, so I'll encourage you and our listeners to go. It's on Criterion Channel. If you look up Vagabond, it's called The Story of an Old Lady. It's about 4 minutes long, but it shows just some documentary footage of her kind of in between scenes. And she seemed very jovial all the time from the clips there. And yeah, what an interesting woman. I never acted before except for Varda's other short film with her in it as well. But yeah, that's probably my favorite part of the movie. I really like that.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that is a really interesting point, because with each of the characters, it feels, many of them are non-professional actors, but many of them feel very sincere and like they're living the experience, and like they're probably, I'm guessing, wearing the clothes that they normally wear. Mm-hmm. And things feel very authentic in that countryside. I guess it's southern France. I really like when Mona is walking through the landscapes and you just see, you know, these fields, the trees, things are very bare. And when she's walking, I really don't know what she could be thinking about, but it gives space to, I think, to the viewer to think about her interactions with other people and how like we would interact. Because when I saw the humane actions of, the lady we spoke about earlier, who's the scientist, the tree expert, she engaged in such a way that was humane. Like you mentioned, this older lady who was really jovial and really like just enjoying the moment. But then other characters were trying to get something out of her, or exploitative, or unsure of how to interact with her because she seems scary in a way. I think one of the characters said, I think it was the technician that was working with the scientist, that yes, she did scare me. And Mona at one point just asked him, "Do I scare you?" And he's like, "Yes, you scare me." And I just think these moments are really interesting and beautiful, that you're getting almost, it's done in a way where it feels very raw and just open, these characters. And like you said, it's set up in a way where they're speaking about her in the interviews and not knowing that she has died. So they're very honest about their feelings about this character. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. And that, speaking of that technician, he ends up coming up again and some interesting ways. So yeah, I think he's on the phone at one point in a phone booth and she's nearby and doesn't know that it's the same person she interacted with before. And she says, yeah. And whoever he's talking to on the phone says, yeah, I am afraid of her, and kind of talks about that. And then, he seems very judgmental towards her, but then he does have this moment where he says, I can understand her confusion. You know, I'm so lost myself sometimes. So there's like a little moment of vulnerability where he's like, I can identify with her though, even though, I can't imagine living like her. Cause at this point she's, I think she's drunk and maybe also on some sort of drugs, and she's with another, like a group of vagabonds. And these are the people who are maybe trying to convince her to be sold into, go into some sort of pornography or sex work, right, that she just seems to not be aware that that's what they want from her. So anyway, that's an interesting moment between them. They almost interact, but she doesn't know she's met this person before. Yeah. There's another character who is really kind to her, and that is, he is an immigrant. I'm trying to remember his character's name, but she comes across him working in a field, and basically there's a lot of workers that are from out of the country, from Morocco, I believe. Yeah, Morocco, yeah. And Tunisia. And most of them are on a vacation to go see their families, except this man who stayed behind, and he's very kind to her. You almost wonder if there's going to be romantic tension between them. And she's allowed to stay in like the quarters where the workers stay and do some work for them. And it ends up not going well in the end. She can't stay once the workers come back. She leaves. But there's a lot of attention paid to this scarf that she, I think it's his scarf, but she wears it frequently, I believe is where that is. But she leaves it sitting on some boxes or something, where when she leaves, she like throws it down, and there's the camera lingers on where that is. Mm-hmm. And then later in the film, he has it, and he says something about, you know, he'll remember her. And I don't know, just a really strong sense of the people leave a mark when they, just like you leave impressions on other people. I think it made me self-reflect in that way, that, you know, how am I affecting the people around me that I'm not always aware of? Because she's very angry when she's leaving. So she's probably thinking that he doesn't care about me, but we as the audience can see that he does. He's in a situation where he can't help her. He doesn't feel like he can help her. And so he's deeply affected, it seems like, by their interactions, even though it's just for a short time.
Right. I really like that scene as well. And the scarf is very powerful. I think near the end of the film, when he is being shown, he's silent for a moment and he pulls the scarf and pulls it to his mouth or his face or nose. And it does seem like he's remembering her in a way. And he does say to her, like, when the others come back from, you know, vacation, I will talk to them and you can stay. But when they come back, he's just unable, it seems like, or he doesn't think he's able to stand up to them. Mm-hmm. And she has to go. And she's really upset about that and angry, because in some ways it seems like she feels as though she would have a place, at least for a while. Mm-hmm. But it's difficult to imagine that she would actually stay, even if she was allowed to. Mm-hmm. For very
long. That sense too, yeah. So I'm almost at the end of kind of the things I noted. The other thing I wanted to bring up was some of the camera work. And there's moments here where the camera lingers on kind of objects, or like a tractor at one point, just kind of seemingly random things around. And that's another kind of, I guess, thing that makes this feel like a documentary, is that we're just getting touches that are, I don't have a purpose other than to kind of just fill out the environment, I guess, kind of build out the world a little bit. And so the only other film I've seen of Varda's is her first feature, which is La Pointe Court. And it's an odd movie, but it has some similar scenes where it's like a boating fishing town, I believe, and there's just shots of boats that kind of are cut in, and that's an interesting thing that seems to be maybe a hallmark of hers, having seen two of her movies. But I watched another of the special features. There's a modern filmmaker named Rebecca Miller, who is interviewed about her feelings on Vagabond, and she talks about these moments in the movie. There are several where maybe Mona's walking and the camera is sort of panning along with her, but the camera sort of passes by her in a way that you wouldn't, it doesn't feel like what you would naturally expect. Like, it's like, why are we going past her? We want to be seeing what she's doing. It'll go way ahead of her and then stop suddenly on a tractor or some inanimate object. And Rebecca Miller makes the point that it's, that is of a piece with the structure of this movie, and that we know that her story is progressing and progressing and progressing, but it is going to end kind of abruptly at some point, maybe before her time. She's going to die. So that was an interesting observation from her, and on the camera, the use of the camera in this movie.
Yeah, I really liked it as well. That even though Mona is the person, the protagonist in a way, we feel only indirect knowing of her. And I think that's important. And the environment and the people around her seem to have as much place and are given enough space as well by Varda to try to get a sense of the atmosphere and others, not just this character. And I think that's a good approach.
Yeah, that's really good. What else do you have? That's kind of the, I'm at the end of my notes of when I watched through it. Do you have any other thoughts about the film before we talk about Varda herself?
A couple of thoughts. There are moments we sort of touched on earlier where Mona is, it seems like, trying to reach out in some way, or she is affected by something. I think with the Tanzanian migrant, when she's speaking to a woman and he says the lady says he's dirty, she just kind of shakes her head, Mona, and just is like, that's not okay to say. It seems like what her face is saying. Mm-hmm. There's also a moment when she's visiting with the farmer and his family, and she's trying to touch the child's face, who's in this window with a goat standing beside the child, and the child kind of moves the face away. And Vanessa pointed this out to me. She tries multiple times to touch the face, and the child keeps moving away. And you kind of see this sense of wanting to connect, wanting to reach out, but being unsure how to do so. And it seems like some of her engagements with people are a bit clumsy or a bit reactive in a way where it's hard for her to be vulnerable. And when she does try to reach out and then she feels rejected, it's very upsetting. Like in the car, I believe the tree expert has said she has to go in, and does Mona understand that she can't go with her, but she can sleep in the car? And Mona's like, okay. And she's like, oh, wait, are you going to lock the doors? And she feels very tense in some way. And she's like, no, you can just, open them or whatever. Any sense of rejection or any sense of things are going badly and people, I'm trying to be okay with people and they're just not being there for me, there is this sense that I'm hurting. And I think she's a very interesting character, and it's important to try to understand her, even though Varda says it's almost an impossible portrait and we're not really knowing her directly. I think empathy and tolerance are really important aspects of this work. Tolerating different lifestyles. The farmer seems to be open to that, but then we find out some of his philosophy gets in the way, and he is not that tolerant, actually. And it's actually some of the other characters, primarily the female characters, who are the most tolerant of Mona and her way of life, even though it may seem rude. Or I think she only says thank you once in the film, and that's something I wanted to say. I believe it's to the nuns who gave her food and said that our doors are always open to you. And then immediately after, we see her closing the door. I'm not saying that's a possibility for her to do, but it feels as though that was she. for her, she did not say thank you very much. She did not. She just kind of said, I want this. This is what I need to do. This, can you do this for me? She did it. She took it. And then she went on with her life. And it felt, in some ways, the farmer, I think, was right, that it is a very lonely life. But it's difficult for me to know if she felt like there were other options. It seemed like mm-hmm. she just, this is my path and I'm going to go down it.
Yeah, that's really interesting about the fact that it's either women who are showing her kindness or it's a foreigner there. Mm-hmm. And so she seems to have a real kinship in a way with him. I think that they are similarly not, you know, of status in society. And so that there's mm-hmm. a connection there. And then, with the old woman who, you know, is upper class, but is a female. And so it's also almost slyly feminist in that way, that it would never, it's not beating you over the head with anything, but it does have that, that common thread. That's really interesting.
Yeah. And I really like that. And I think, the approach for what you were saying earlier about allowing the audience to engage with the film as they want, sort of actually, related to, in some ways, Stalker, Tarkovsky's style of having this respect for the audience. I think that's really something that Varda is doing here, allowing, I think there was an article that I read where she's interviewed and she says, Vagamon is like a mirror game or puzzle in which others bring their pieces. In this mirror game, we learn more about the people who react to her than about Mona. Instead of an impossible portrait of Mona, I make a portrait of the French countryside. Mm. So it's allowing us to bring our own pieces and our own selves. And she also said, I wanted to deal with the subject as the subject is. You bump into her and know nothing about her, and all you can catch is what she is now. As a writer, I chose to forget about the writer's position and acknowledge that I don't know or understand her totally. I invented a character who eludes me. And she said, I want spectators to define themselves in their relationship, basically, with Mona. Would you, you know, what would you do? How would you react? How would you engage? And all these questions really matter in, like, understanding this character and the rest of the characters in the film. So, yeah, I think the approach is really a good one by Varda for this sort of story and how the style that she told this. And in a way, like you said about Citizen Kane, we know the end in the beginning, but it's how we got there and what it means and who these people are that really matters.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that Tarkovsky connection, but yeah, like the audience brings, like the audience reaction is a huge part of the importance of the work. That's really cool. Mm. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Agnes Varda herself. So as I mentioned, I've only seen one of her other films, La Pointe Court. I watched her first one, you know, so I can watch through them in order, but I haven't gotten very far yet. There's actually a great box set coming out. We were talking about recently, Andrew, the Criterion Collection is putting out, I think it's all of her collected work. She passed away last year in March 2019 and was still working up until her death. And that's about as much as I know about her, other than she was very influential in the French New Wave, and I think one of the few female filmmakers in that period that was had as much notoriety as she did. But yeah, what else can you tell us about Agnes Varda?
I know that she started out in her professional career with photography. She studied mm-hmm. photography, and she was doing a lot of still photography before she got into filmmaking. I think that her study and her work in photography comes out in her films. Mm-hmm. Things are well composed. I think she lingers on subjects the right amount of time. Mm-hmm. And her portraits are really, really nice. There's an idea that she speaks about that I think that she created this term. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Cinecriture or something. That's like a French word for like cinematic writing. And she has this idea that cinema, storytelling, and like having a good story is more than just like writing a script. It's all the decisions you make that go into how you're like, what lens you're using, where you're shooting. Are you using non-professional or professional actors? Are you creating a story as you go in the film? There are so many decisions that you're doing when you're making a film, and it's not just about a screenplay. And she thinks there's an over reliance, potentially like in Hollywood or in other, I guess more corporate kind of filmmaking, where we have a lot of focus on the script. The script really matters. And she says, yeah, the script does matter, but there are many more decisions that are also very important. And the script, the writing can be good, but if it's not enacted or all these other decisions aren't made in a great way, then your film's not going to be that good. And I think that's a really important feature of her work. And as we see, it's almost like she meets these people, these non-professional actors, and incorporates them into a film that she's already has an idea of. And I think that's something that some directors would never even consider, because it seems too off the cuff.
Yeah, kind of risky. Yeah, and it's interesting. So like seeing the commonality between Tarkovsky and her in the way they really in really strongly invite the audience reaction to what they're doing. But very different in that way, because he seems very tightly scripted from what little I know of his work. Whereas I guess you could say she's pretty loosely scripted as she's going, writing as she goes and creating the story out of what she finds. That's maybe unique. And as far as what I know about filmmakers, the way she's doing that seemed to work really well for her. She made some really great movies.
Right. And I really like the documentary style, this blurring that we kind of spoke about between fact and fiction. And she made a lot of documentaries. And I think that's really interesting. And you mentioned something earlier about like the class distinction, like melts away in some of these scenes when people are just interacting. And it seems as though she really cared about people on the margins of society. I think that's clear in this film for sure. Humanizing them, not, you know, acting as if, okay, you're not useful to society. What role are you performing? Therefore you're useless in some way. It's actually, you really matter, and these people matter, and they need to be shown. Their lives need to be depicted in ways that are, that are humane, that are not just like limiting them to like, okay, you're just whatever in society. We don't really care.
Involved in it, maybe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's really important, because in many films, we're not seeing people. I mean, we are now, I think, but in the period of time she's making this film in 85, and then previously in the 60s and 70s during the French New Wave, many films were not focused on what would be considered the, you know, untouchables of society, or those who are homeless, or, and if they are, it's almost either a romanticized view or it's a some sort of condemnation. And I think she really allows a more dynamic portrait to be made of people in these situations. And I think that's great. Like the migrant worker, there are these really good qualities about this migrant worker, but then it's like, well, the migrant worker still didn't kind of go with what he said. Yeah. And I think people are shown in nuance and not just characters.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good point. And there's like there's a humanism maybe built into that, where, I don't know, thinking about, you know, an anti-capitalist idea maybe of like people's usefulness isn't their worth maybe, but rather, yeah, seeing a real picture of someone, and by showing us even indirectly by looking at closely at a person, you see the beauty, and looking closely with respect and dignity, as you were kind of mentioning, you see the beauty in all of us maybe. And I think that's an amazing thing that she did. With it seems like an indirect way to tell that, but it's such a powerful way to kind of get to that idea.
Yeah.
Well, I am dying to dig into more Varda now, which I know a lot of it is streaming on Criterion Channel. Do you have like one or two others of hers that are among your favorites, or how many have you seen of her films?
I have seen Cleo from 5 to 7, and I've seen pieces of, I think it's Varda on the Beach or something like that.
Yeah, it's like, but, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but I want to see more. I'm excited for this Criterion box set with all her films. I'm going to definitely get into that. I think the first film that you stated, I think, is important to see. I need to see it. I think for many directors, that's an important place to start. But Cleo from 5 to 7, I think, is her other, along with Vagabond, one of her critically acclaimed films. And I think that is a really important film in cinema history. And as far as her influence on the French New Wave, I think she was also considered part of sort of like the left bank, which was a bit more experimental at the time than what's considered like proper French New Wave with like Godard, Truffaut. But yeah, I think she was one of the only female filmmakers at the time that had that sort of, I think, following and critical acclaim and platform. But she has said, I think, in interviews before she died in the last 5 to 10 years, she had stated that it was always very difficult for her to get funding, that it was very difficult to make the films that she wanted to make, even though she said she would always be remembered in like libraries and, you know, cinema history that people talk about how much they love her, but they're not really supporting her making the films. Mm-hmm. And she was a little frustrated at that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Have heard, so one of her most recent films is called Faces Places, and it's a documentary where she partnered with this photographer named JR. And it's so funny, when I think when I first got Instagram, I looked up who should I be following, like good photographers, and I was following JR for a long time and had seen several of his things there, and then I heard a podcast breaking down what Faces Places is about, and it's this partnership between those two. I'm like, oh well, it's that guy from Instagram. But it's an interesting premise. They go around to villages and they take photos of really high quality photos of just regular people, and they blow them up and print them on enormous, like on the sides of trucks and the sides of buildings and stuff, and then kind of film the reactions of the villagers. And it's another way of showing the importance of regular people, I think. But that's a really recent one, like in the last, I think, 2017 that came out. And that's the only other of her films that I know a whole lot about is that one. And that's because of a podcast interview I heard. I also love the French title, Faces, Places, the English. The French is Visages, Villages, which I've always loved that word, Visages, as like the word for the face. But anyway, yeah, so that's my other knowledge of her. But yeah, I'm going to have to save up for that box set as well and dig through these as I go.
Yeah. I wanted to say a few more things about like her as a filmmaker, things that I took quotes from her, just like interviews and articles online that I think are interesting about her work that may give some, at least like a view of what she's about and kind of what her films, what she's trying, not what she's trying to do, but what she cares about, it seems like, at least to me.
Yeah.
She talks about the principle of free association. Always keep faith and chance in mind. I always appeal to faith and chance. When I start shooting, chance is my first assistant. I benefit from it when making films with new ideas and randomly appearing people, as we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. This very kind of spontaneous, kind of improvisational way of filmmaking. There is a line, let's see. Okay. She says inspiration, creation, and sharing. I think this is from a TED talk, I believe. She said, desire is the essence of life. Art feeds us. It is the way you look at things that make them beautiful. The truth is difficult. The truth is very interesting.
Wow. That's really interesting. I like that. It's the way you look at things that makes them beautiful. Like beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And she kind of, in her films, it really helps us to look at things we might not otherwise look at and see the beauty in them. That's really cool.
Yeah. And I really like that. And then there was a line where she says, sharing is more interesting than anything. I think that's really powerful. The sharing is, and that goes back to Bergman as well, I think, and Tarkovsky, and in a way, Ozu. I think for all these filmmakers that we've gone through in this season, communicating is really important, and sharing it in whatever way that is. The films seem to be trying to share human connection, our interactions with other people, what it means to like know someone, what it means to try to be humane to someone. I think these are really important things, and all of these filmmakers go about it in different ways, different styles, but I do like the focus on communication and sharing. There's a lot of very humanistic focus, I think.
Yeah, that's really cool. And depicting the relationships, even when they're challenging, thinking about like the family dynamics in Tokyo Story, but through seeing what feels like a real relationship, and seeing the beauty in that, I think that, yeah, that's a really cool common thread through all of these. Yeah.
Yeah, and I have one last quote, sure. And I think this one is really interesting for this film too. She says, "Poetry plays a very important role for me because with words it opens gates and windows, and then you can draw breath or not. My working motto is that poetry is like a key which opens no doors, like a lost key, or even better, a door for which you lost your key. I try to open windows for the audience, open windows for them to leave the film and go and vagabond."
Well, yeah, so that has direct connection here. A window is literally the way some people travel into this house, in and out. So that's kind of funny, but yeah, and that's another connection to our previous discussions. We keep talking about poetic cinema and poetry and how we can compare some of these things to maybe you relate to an art house film more like you would relate to a poem than a novel or something. And so that's really interesting to hear her bring that connection directly and how she sees poetry.
Yeah, and I like the idea of opening this window and like we're going out and now we can go vagabond for ourselves. We can like find our own pathway. I really like that openness about her filmmaking.
That's beautiful. I love that. And that is Vagabond. Sounds like we both recommend it very highly. Streaming on Criterion Channel and coming soon from a Criterion box set as well. But that will do it for this episode. Let me look and see what is next week. I think it's Blue from Kieslowski, another that I have not ever seen. So I'm excited to see that. And I've heard nothing but incredible things about it. So that'll be for next time. And till then, we will say farewell. Thanks so much for being here, Andrew, and we'll talk to you again in the next episode. If you listeners want to support the show, you can leave a rating or review on iTunes or whatever podcast app you are using. You can keep up with Art House Garage on social media at Art House Garage on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd. You can also go to the website or to YouTube, and there are some reviews. There's also some event coverage on the blog there at arthousegarage.com. You can also hit me up at email at andrew@arthousegarage.com. And I think that's about everything. So thanks again for listening. That will do it for this episode. And until next time, keep it snob free.